Hi, everybody. We want to thank our sponsor, Legion M. They are a wonderful company. We love working with them. You can go to their website, Legion M. They're also on all the various socials. They do really fun meetups. You can talk to directors. You can become a part of the projects they choose. They even have a program right now where you can help them find great movies to support. So go to their website to learn more. We also want to remind you that we have a Patreon that we call Maltreon. You can join us. We have $3, $5, $10, $20 options. You can get newsletters from my dad, all kinds of neat stuff behind the scenes. Hang out with us, learn about who our guests are before anybody else, and listen to the podcast before anybody else. Go to patreon.com/maltononmovies for more information.
That's patreon.com/maltononmovies.
Hi, everybody. I'm Leonard Maltin.
And I'm Jesse Maltin.
And you're listening to Maltin on Movies. And if you have YouTube on, you're watching Maltin on Movies.
That's right. Two Maltins on the movies.
On the movies. Animated movies today.
Animated. Animation in general.
Mm-hmm.
Something that obviously is always played a big role in our lives and certainly in your career has been animation. And whether it's because people read your book, which many, I have to tell you that one of the coolest things in the world to me is that some of your books are used in school. Because I feel like that there's no greater accomplishment really than writing something that people feel is so valuable that it's what students need to read.
Well, I'm grateful. The book I wrote of Mice and Magic, A History of American Animated Cartoons.
My mother came up with the title. Everyone remember at all times, my mother came up with the title. If you don't say that, she will murder you in the night. Go on.
Well, it's a good title.
It's a great title.
It's the title of a 1950s cartoon, and that's she was typing up the manuscript.
Yes.
And when she saw that title, she said, this would work. I said, you're right, which is why we're still married.
I
said, you're right. And I've never regretted it. It's a wonderful title. That book is now 40 years old.
It's crazy.
Stupefying.
The book is older than I am.
That's right. And the only reason it is still in print is because it gets adopted by high school and college courses on the history of animation. And I'm very grateful for that. And this past year, it was published in Russia.
Which is so wild. We got a friend of yours, I guess, sent us a copy of it. And I never knew what Maltin looked like in Cyrillic letters, but here we are. incredibly cool. We have a movie guide. We have a couple of your books translated into different languages, which I enjoy immensely.
Mm-hmm.
So as I say, animation is such a big part of our lives. It's such a big part of your life.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just thought it would be fun to talk about it and why it has always been what it is to you. We also got to talk to your pal, Mark Evanier.
Right.
And Jerry Beck. Two folks who really, they keep so much alive, and like you are dedicated to this art form,
mm-hmm.
And they've got great stories to share. So we're sort of doing multi-part, all things animation.
So, starting with us.
Starting with us, that's right.
Well, my timing in life, well, it was very good, period. I grew up at a perfect time to be an old movie buff,
mm-hmm.
because I was born in December 1950, so I grew up in the first television generation. 5 years earlier, I wouldn't have started out on TV. I would have been listening to radio.
Mm.
But when I was about 3 or 4, I guess we must have gotten our first TV set. And I remember it. It was a console box-like set, and it had little slats in the side for the speakers.
Yeah.
Which had fabric, covered in fabric, and it looked like slots in a piggy bank. And I used to put coins in there from time to time, which I don't think helped the operation of the television set. Anyway, the television in New York was 7 channels. A lot of cities only had 3, 4 at most. We had 7 channels, and they needed something to fill up all that airtime. So the local stations, not the networks, but the local TV stations, bought packages of old cartoons, and I mean even silent era cartoons with music tracks on them. So I grew up watching the whole spectrum of American animation. Terry Toons, founded by Paul Terry, Warner Brothers cartoons of the vintage era, Ub Iwerks cartoons, the Van Buren cartoons. These are obscure studios.
Yeah, yeah.
But I saw them all. And of course, you know, they ran out of new material, so they kept repeating it. So when you watch something, as you're accustomed to doing in your generation, by replaying it
yes.
over and over, TV was replaying it for me. And that's why it all stuck with me. And something in me fostered a curiosity to know about them, to know something about them, about why these names were starting to look familiar. Who was Ub Iwerks? Why did Felix the Cat show up suddenly in color? In
you
a couple
mean
of them.
This Felix?
Yeah, that guy.
This Felix. For those of you not watching, my dad has a gigantic Felix head pillow, and it is perched behind me right now.
Mm-hmm. You can prove that. You can go to YouTube
look,
and see
really
for yourself.
Has it.
Yeah. Plus, Walt Disney went on the air in 1954 with his weekly TV show, originally called Disneyland,
mm-hmm.
because it was intended to promote the upcoming opening of his theme park. And he also launched the Mickey Mouse Club. So I became Disney-fied pretty early on.
Yeah.
So being exposed to all of this was crucial,
mm-hmm.
crucial to my young life. One of the things Walt Disney did was he took us behind the scenes, showed us how animation was created, and went into his own history, explained the significance of Steamboat Willie and the use of a soundtrack for the first time, or the introduction of color. We didn't have color TV then, but the introduction of color in flowers and trees. So I started to learn things like this, and that Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs was his first feature-length cartoon. And I went to my local library in Teaneck, New Jersey, and there was one book that I could turn to read about all of this, and that's called The Art of Animation by Bob Thomas.
With the staff of the Walt Disney Studio.
And it turns out this book was actually meant as a promotional item for the upcoming release of Sleeping Beauty in 1959. So it does cover like a general history of animation, and it's beautifully illustrated, and it has IDs for all sorts of people at the studio.
Yeah.
Their pictures and illustrations. And then it becomes, you know, exclusively Disney-centric.
Yeah.
But it's very clear.
It's beautiful.
It's a beautiful
what
book.
A beautiful
lots of
full book.
Color stuff. Lots of illustrations from Sleeping Beauty, but also general illustrations of what a soundstage is, what, you know, what sketches are, storyboards, concept art, the multiplane camera, animation drawings, sequence by sequence.
And if you've never seen a multi-plane camera, take a moment and look it up online. Look up, I'm sure there are videos on YouTube. Take a moment and check it out because it's genuinely, it's mind-blowing. They have one in right by the Disney archives here in Burbank. And as a kid, when I would walk by it, it just looks like some sort of a science experiment, which I guess in a sense it is.
Yeah, true.
But it's huge. I mean, how tall must it be?
Well, I don't know. I mean,
15
I'm
feet?
15 feet tall. That's
give
a good
or take
guess.
15 feet. And to see that, regardless of age, you know, it blew my mind as a kid, but I'm sure you had quite the reaction to it as well.
Absolutely.
And of course, having it be there on the Disney lot was also mm-hmm. pretty neat.
So anyway, the nice thing about this book is very clear. It doesn't talk down to childish readers or childlike readers. It's just very clearly stated. And it has a lot of illustrations that show the key members of the staff. And here's a picture of Clarence Nash, who's the voice, original voice of Donald Duck, with Florence Gill, who was Clara Cluck. And many years later, not that many actually, I met and became friendly with Bob Thomas, mm-hmm. Who wrote many, many wonderful books on Hollywood history. And he eventually updated this about 20 years later. And I think I had him sign that copy, but not this one. And so this is a very important book to me,
yeah.
But it's also a really good book. I mean, if you have anyone of any age who's interested in a primer, a beginner's guide to animation, you could do a lot worse than to start with this.
It's true.
Even though, as I say, it is Disney-centric, but it talks about Gertie the Dinosaur and Winsor McCay's pioneering film and how it influenced a whole generation.
The thing for me, I often wax poetic about books, but I'm always sort of mesmerized by the fact that, so how old is this book? When did you get this book?
Well, I read it, I guess, when I was 8 or 9 years old. Mm-hmm. I was 8 years old in 1959 when Sleeping Beauty came out.
Right.
So I think it would have been around that time.
And when do you think you got this?
It was not an inexpensive book. Mm-hmm. I don't know when I had enough money to buy one.
Yeah, the copyright on it is 1958. What blows my mind truly is that books don't age. Hmm. Yes, physically, sometimes the pages will start to go yellow and the spine will start to get worn. But there's something part of what makes books this magical entity is that anybody can pick one of these up and they don't know that it was published in 1958. All they see is an explanation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what does this person do? What does that person do? Oh my God, there's the voice of Donald Duck. There's the mm-hmm. voice of Clara Cluck, one of the greatest names ever, Clara Cluck. But I don't know. It just, and when I hold them, I just feel that. It brings me joy.
Yes, books bring me a joy and satisfaction yeah. and they transport me. At the same time that Walt Disney was doing what he was doing every week, in the late 50s, along came the Woody Woodpecker Show, which mm-hmm. was a syndicated half-hour show
oh.
hosted by Woody's creator, Walter Lantz. And I think this book called Walter Lantz, Easy Way to Draw. Oh, it's the authorized
yes,
edition.
Yes, the authorized edition.
With a wonderful cover.
It is.
Of Woody drawing himself on a drawing board. Walter Lantz's show every week did a behind-the-scenes segment that in many ways was more instructional than Walt Disney's.
Huh.
Because he just took one aspect of animation every week. I remember the episode about exposure sheets and how first they recorded the dialogue and then the animator would take a look at this exposure sheet to see when the first ha would come out of Woody's voice. And that's where you want to have the beak beginning to open. And then he followed the pencil line down to where it was fully open. Ha, 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 ha. You know, and it was, again, very clear and very good. So I think this book costs like $4.99. Wow. Look at the end papers with
it's great.
Multiple Woodies. And to go out of sequence for a
end
moment.
End papers.
Yeah.
That is not a term I knew.
Oh, yeah.
End papers.
Now, 1977, New York City, the Oak Room of the Plaza Hotel, I got to meet Walter Lantz, and I had him sign.
Let me hold that up so you don't cover your face.
Spine is very delicate, so
yes.
Be careful.
Yes, yes.
But he signed the book to me, which I'd had all those years.
To Leonard, with best wishes, Walter Lantz and Woody Woodpecker, June 19th, 1977.
He was in town for a tribute at the Museum of Modern Art, and I was then working at MoMA.
I love the little Woodies in those lenses.
Mm-hmm.
Gosh.
And there's Walter on the back. There's yes. a good picture of Walter at the drawing board on the back.
Yeah.
Walter Lantz, I believe, was one of the people who was drawn, no pun,
hey.
Who was turned on to animation by seeing Winsor McCay's Gertie the Dinosaur in 1914.
Let's talk about Gertie for a second.
Sure.
Because it's not it's one of those things where not everyone will know who Gertie is. Again, my goal, when I told my dad I wanted to do several episodes about animation, is I wanted it to be something where if you know everything, you enjoy listening to this. And if you know nothing, you learn. So something like Gertie to an animation buff, or even just someone who's started to get into it, that may not be news. But if you don't know, Gertie the dinosaur is...
was the creation of the man regarded as America's foremost newspaper cartoonist, Winsor McCay. And Winsor McCay drew... he started coming to prominence, I think, at the turn of the 20th century, in the early 1900s. And he did the most extraordinary full-page cartoons, The Dreams of a Rarebit Fiend and Little Nemo in Slumberland. And there are reprints of these things in giant-sized books because newspapers in those days were enormous. I mean, look at the LA Times or the New York Times or the Washington Post. They're not nearly as big, as broad, as wide, as deep as papers ordinarily were.
Think about the menu size at a deli. And that's give or take how big the newspapers were.
Anyway, McCay was a superb draftsman and with an incredibly vivid imagination. And he's worth looking up. And you can find examples of his work online very easily, both his drawings and his early animation. He got intrigued with animation. Now, who made the first animated film? Doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
A Frenchman named Emile Cohl, C-O-H-L, is one of the people credited with that. Humorous Phases of Funny Faces. There, J. Stuart Blackton. There are other early experimenters. One of them used chalk on a chalkboard, and by erasing and changing by and moving the camera forward a couple of frames, he made things come to life. Winsor McCay made a couple of animated films as experiments, kind of an indulgence. He was very well paid. He was a very popular newspaper cartoonist. But in 1914, he developed a vaudeville act using animation. He would wear a ringmaster's costume and stand on the side of a stage and command Gertie to come on screen. And it was like a multimedia event. Suddenly on the giant screen would come this enormous dinosaur who can only be described as cute.
Adorable. It's adorable.
A very appealing character is Gertie. And McCay meant this to be a presentation, not just a film, but a presentation. Ultimately, he filmed an introduction, sort of a wraparound introduction, as we call it today, so that it could stand on its own as a 10-minute film. And that's what you may see if you find a copy of Gertie the Dinosaur online. He imbued this character, drawn with a very fine line of ink, with personality. And it didn't just move. It had a personality, or she had a personality. And that's what knocked people out. They'd seen movement before, but they hadn't seen something like this. This was magic. This was capturing lightning in a bottle. Walt Disney even recreated the presentation on an episode of his Disneyland show.
Wow.
And he had the head of his music department, Oliver Wallace, dress up as somebody would in 1914 to recreate Gertie. Because Walt, like everybody else, knew it all really started there. But a lot of people in the newspaper game who were present when he first presented Gertie said, I want to do that too. And they included Max Fleischer and I think Walter Lantz, if I'm not mistaken, Paul Terry. The influence of that cartoon cannot be overstated. And it still is charming today.
It remains. It's one of those that when you watch it, there are certain things that require an introduction. And there's certain things we have to say now. This is what we had with this and this, and this is what this represented, and blah, blah, blah. But Gertie is just cute and fun. It actually, I always feel like she looks like the animated versions of the Loch Ness Monster. I feel like they look quite similar. Every time you see a Gertie, it looks quite a bit like Nessie. But yeah, it's just a delight.
It is.
And you understand. I think anybody would understand. And certainly, again, if somebody was trying to get into animation even now, seeing something as simple as Gertie.
Yeah. And seeing the power that just pen and ink drawings can have, that there is that potential, that possibility is really awesome. A word I don't use very much. But in this case, it's true.
It's true. Produces awe. Thusly, it is awesome.
Now, Max Fleischer and his brother Dave had an idea that tried to leapfrog over what Winsor McCay had done so painstakingly. They took a motion picture camera. Dave put on a clown suit, and Max shot footage of him tumbling, falling down, getting up, gyrating around in this clown suit. And then they invented a device called the rotoscope. It's a word that's still used in the visual effects field.
Yeah.
And they traced every frame. So what they got from doing that was very natural flow of motion. It was not somebody imitating movement. It was somebody recreating movement with pen and ink.
And again, now people are very familiar with this. A lot of people, you'll see, this is so-and-so. Hell, I mean, when Groot dancing, you know, a lot of people have now seen the videos of James Gunn dancing around and that becoming that same Andy Serkis, you know. But again, then the idea of taking something, actual movement, and mimicking it that closely.
So when the Fleischer brothers brought this to, I think, to J.R. Bray, who was running a young animation studio in New York, he said, well, this is great. Can you give me one a month? And they said, no, this took forever. This took, you know, ages and ages to do. And he said, well, what you've done is really good, but unless you can do it on a schedule, it's useless. So he did contract with them, and they started their Out of the Inkwell series featuring Coco the Clown. With a K, Coco the Clown. And they didn't do all of it with rotoscope. They used freehand drawings for some and rotoscoping for certain scenes where they wanted the effect to be very lifelike. And on that basis, they became a success. And that's what launched the Fleischers, and who later went on to do the Betty Boop cartoons and Popeye, and they invented the bouncing ball.
It's one of your favorite things in the world.
In the world,
bouncing ball.
So that was the next step. By the way, they got a patent for the rotoscope, which I sent away to the U.S. Patent Office and got a copy of. It was a device that no one had ever thought of before. They later patented a rotograph, which allowed them to use existing moving film. I'm going to get this wrong. They went a step further with the rotoscope. Anyhow, the rotoscope was a big deal. Funny, 20 years later, when Walt Disney was working on Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, they hired a talented teenager, a dancer named Marjorie Belcher, who later became very famous under her married name, Marge Champion, a wonderful dancer. And she danced for them as Snow White. They wanted to see not only her body movement, but the swirl of her skirt.
Yes.
And so that they could reproduce that for Snow White. And they found that when they traced her exactly, it didn't look right on screen. They were better off just using that footage for reference, which is what they did all the years afterwards.
Yeah, again and again.
Feature films.
And you'll find photos and sometimes videos that they still have of different people, and that's how they got into. In the same way that you'll see someone bringing a lion into a room, and that's how they're figuring out how to draw the lion.
Yeah. So as an artist would have a model you know, for life drawing class. The Disney folks found that having live models for the animation was very, very useful. And they would do rudimentary sets so that if she was going to a well and leaning over, they would have a, you know, a,
Just something there so that the movement looked authentic.
Yeah. So the result of all of that was the animation business became a business. Mm-hmm. And you know who mourned that? Winsor McCay. I have a quote in my book. I forget where I found it. But he, in the 1920s, he attended a dinner, I think in his honor, from the New York, and this is all in New York City, by the way. Winsor McCay, the newspaper world was based in New York, and the early animation world was entirely in New York until the 20s. And he said to these guys, "You've made it a business. I wanted it to be an art."
Oh.
And you know, it's it was the truth.
Yeah.
But they had a compromise. They had a compromise in order to make it a practical reality, to be able to make films that distributors could get into theaters and people could see. And those films from the 20s wound up, a lot of them, on television during my childhood. So I was introduced to quite a lot of this. And with that, only that one book, The Art of Animation, to go as my guide. And eventually, and I mean eventually, as the years passed, I wrote a book because it's the book I wanted to have. It's the book I wanted to read and be able to consult. And I wound up teaching a course in the history of animation at the New School for Social Research.
New School for Social Research.
It always gets stuck in my tongue.
It's okay. In New York City.
In New York City. I started teaching it in 1973. And a year after I got out of college. And I taught this weekly class for 9 years. Mm-hmm. And over the course of that time, I kind of became a magnet for all the lost boys.
Yes.
In the New York area. Who were all animation buffs. And some of them were aspiring animators. But there was nowhere to see this stuff on a regular basis. And a lot of it had drifted away from television by that time. TV had moved on to newer cartoons. I mean, there was still a lot being shown, but not the way they were back in the 50s. So I made a lifelong friend there, Jerry Beck.
Mm-hmm.
And Jerry, who has written numerous books and runs cartoonresearch.com, a great, great website, and is now currently teaching animation courses at no less than three institutions here in L.A. because he's subbing for Charles Solomon at UCLA.
Yep.
He's been teaching at Cal Arts for a while, and he's also been teaching at Woodbury College.
Yep. I love it.
So
I love it.
Jerry and I just hit it off, and he wound up doing all the work for the filmographies in that book of Mice and Magic. Wow. And tagging along near him was a guy named Will Friedwald.
Yep.
Who is now an esteemed author and jazz expert, and he collaborated with Jerry on a book on the Warner Brothers cartoons. Yep. And Tom Cito, who was president of the Cartoonist Guild, the
ASIFA,
union.
ASIFA.
Well, no, but also the guild. And has been teaching at USC for a long time now. Also authored several books, including a very good book on computer animation. Ed Catmull came to that class on a number of occasions, who wound up, you know, co-running Pixar.
Yeah.
An animator named Dan Haskett. Other people in the, you know, in the field who actually did, you know, wind up doing this for a living.
You found each other.
Yes.
You know, you found each other. And you were saying to me that if it weren't for that class, you don't know that you would have written this book.
The act of teaching and having to organize my thoughts as well as my research enabled me to write the book. Because if I'd sat down on one day, you know, from point zero and said, okay, now I'm going to write a book, and what do I think about how this developed, and, you know, why the personality of that studio was distinctive from this other studio. I don't know if I could have done it.
Hmm.
But the again, timing, my timing was great. I mean, after, I met Walter Lantz, for crying out loud. Walter Lantz came to New York, and I was fortunate to meet him there. But then I did a long interview with him by phone, and my phone bill started going up. Because as I started getting connections and numbers, I spent a lot of time talking to, and then eventually meeting, Chuck Jones, Friz Freleng.
Chuck, who I should tell you, looks so much like Sylvester. I cannot even, to me, he looks like Sylvester in the best way. I guess a little Bugs too, but just his face to me, he's always looked like this sort of sassy cat. But
My first trip out here, my second trip out here, I got to meet Ward Kimball.
Oh, when Ward's
at Disney, and Ward was one of a kind. And later Frank Thomas and Ollie Johnston and others at Disney. I mean, people from so many different studios, so many different backgrounds. There was a lovely man named Al Eugster, who never became a star animator, but he was a good animator. And his first job was blacking in Felix the Cat at the Felix Studio in New York City.
And
that was in the 20s.
Wow.
I talked quite a lot to Seamus Culhane, whose real name was James Culhane. He later adopted the Irish variation Seamus. And Seamus also started, I think, with Fleischer and wound up at Disney for a while and then moved back to New York. A lot of them migrated from studio to studio. And I got to talk to them. And, you know, how lucky am I to have had that experience? Had I started 5 years earlier, I would have gotten to even more people. But I really did touch a lot of giants.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, you and I are both words like legend and icon and things like that. We do try to, we tend to try to stay away from them a bit. But then there are some people where that is what they were and that is what they represented. And the nine old men, again, a term, if you are a Disney nerd especially, you'll know the nine old men. If not, it's a great thing to look up. These guys were the heavies.
The heavyweights.
The heavyweights, and Walt Disney relied on them heavily. But it's those men and the fact that they were still, even when I was younger, that they were still around. Many of them were still around.
Yeah.
And you talk to them. It's just, and what you all share collectively is a youthfulness, a childlike quality. I've heard many of the wives bitching about it. No, I'm kidding. I'm half kidding. But it's true.
Well,
it is
both Ward
a wonderful.
Kimball, both Ward Kimball and Ollie Johnston married young women who were in the ink and paint department at Disney.
Which I love. I love that.
You know, and I went to interview them.
Yeah.
It's you know, there's so many different routes you can follow to trace this history.
Yeah.
And then I met Bill Hanna and Joe Barbera.
Yep.
Who goosed the MGM Cartoon Studio into new life in the 1940s and won 7 Academy Awards doing their brilliant Tom and Jerry series. Getting to see the films was very challenging at that moment. I rented a lot of prints, 16mm prints for my class, but I found out that the rental companies didn't know one cartoon from another. And they didn't think it mattered.
Oh God.
I would rent, had to rent a reel of 3.
Yeah.
And I wanted the second one. They'd have replaced it with another one. No, I didn't want just another cartoon. I wanted this specific cartoon. Oh dear.
I can't it's nutty. And you've got more show and tell.
Well, yes. In recent years, not when I was a kid, I did get hold of this as Betty Boop's Movie Cartoon Lessons, How to Make Movie Cartoons by Max Fleischer.
Wow.
And it's really wonderful. It is. Wonderful illustrations.
It's also, I think, it serves you when you start to understand who created what. So Fleischer is that's a very distinct style.
Yes.
And once you recognize Fleischer, you will always recognize Fleischer.
Yeah.
Unless someone is imitating. In a similar vein, you know, whether it's Al Hirschfeld or whoever it is, you know, they have certain styles. People have adopted them. But there's only one, and you know when you're looking at it. You really do. And again, joyful, funny. I think Grampy has to be one of our favorite characters
yes,
ever.
Yes, he is. The unsung Grampy.
Yes. We love...
For a couple of years with Betty Boop.
We love him.
And I show those cartoons to my class at USC, and they always play.
Always play. I do. I love Grampy. I think he is one of my
What's funny
favorites.
Is I talked to some of the Fleischer veterans, and they didn't think much of what they were doing in the 30s because they were working in New York,
in
Midtown Manhattan, and whenever the newest Disney release would come and play on Broadway, on Times Square, they would go to the theater and see it and come away dejected because they felt what they were doing was just, you know, a little pipsqueak of a noise, and Disney was doing, you know, a giant orchestra at that time. But that's what made them different.
Yes.
It was that distinction that they had that they didn't value.
Yeah. Well, that's when you will listen to the episode, you will. If you would like to listen to the episode with Mark Evanier, you know, he worked for Hanna-Barbera, so he has a lot of stories of being there. And one of the names that came up that had me gobsmacked, a word you love, Tex Avery.
Mm-hmm.
Because truly, Tex Avery and those visuals, whether it's Little Hot Riding Hood.
No, Red Hot Riding Hood.
Red Hot Riding Hood.
Then there's another cartoon called Little Rural Riding Hood.
Thank you. This is the Abadi. It's tongue twisters. That, what he called the Tex Avery take, that where the eyes get big and everything. It's, as I say, once you recognize someone's style, as with anything else, you start to go, oh, that's what that is. Yeah. And that's just what they're imitating.
You just reminded me that I also met Mel Blanc.
I can't.
The immortal
I can't.
Mel Blanc, who did the voices of
everyone.
Everybody at Warner Brothers cartoons, except Elmer Fudd.
Yeah.
The only one he didn't do, a wonderful radio actor named Arthur Q. Bryan, was Elmer. And then you also reminded me that I met and became very friendly with Bob Clampett.
Yes.
Another of the great Warner Brothers guys.
Yeah.
And Bob was very generous. I got hold of some stills of behind-the-scenes staff at work at the Leon Schlesinger studio, and I sent Xeroxes to Bob, and he not only identified a lot of people for me, he sent the Xeroxes to an inker painter friend of his who identified even more.
Wow.
I mean, people were so generous to me. They were, and also, of course, they were happy to be finally being recognized.
Well, that's the thing. I think that for all of you, mm-hmm. for your grouping of friends who do this, you know, this comes from a place of love.
Mm-hmm.
And I do believe that people recognize that. And when they see that you are genuinely excited and genuinely want to speak about, you know, this subject that means so much to them, it's a happy thing.
I mean, you may know some of, say, Chuck Jones' great cartoons like The Rabbit of Seville or Duck Amuck or What's Opera Doc or One Froggy Evening. Imagine making those cartoons and getting no response, no write-ups in the newspaper or the weekly news magazines, no hosannas from film critics anywhere.
Again, talk about aging well, though.
Yeah.
Again, if you told most kids how old certain, whether they're shorts or mm-hmm. features are, they wouldn't believe you.
Yeah.
And a character like Bugs Bunny, especially because he is so sassy.
Mm-hmm.
Bugs is sassy as hell. Would you think that this was not made yesterday?
No.
You know, and that's funny is funny. Good writing is good writing. And this is true for all things. But I do every now and then. I think about certain moments like that, and I go, God, that was, when did it come out?
Yeah,
because to me, it doesn't age.
Looking at the new Blu-ray of Tex Avery cartoons,
which
Warner Archive released,
I don't even think you watched it. It's like you devoured it, and it became a part of your person.
Pretty close.
Yeah.
I realized how many years it had been since I'd seen some of them. They're overpoweringly funny.
Yeah.
And they look fast and they look clever today. Imagine what they must have looked like in the 40s. So an audience moved at a slower pace. Life didn't, you know, gallop in those days as it does today.
Yeah.
If they look that extreme to us in the year 2020,
I can't.
What must it have looked like in 1947? I can't begin to imagine.
Talk about that a little bit. So we have Disney, which, again, there's so much information out there now, but obviously everything that Walt did was his and exceptional.
Animation at Walt Disney went on two tracks, the main track being the development of the feature-length cartoon. And there's so much to be said about that. And people will be writing about those forever.
Ever, yeah.
And there are now so many books where there was only one.
Yeah.
When I was 8 or 9 years old. Now there are dozens and dozens and dozens. But the other track, the less prestigious, less celebrated track, was the short subjects. Now, the shorts originally were where all the milestones occurred, and where the shorts in the 30s were their R&D lab, the research and development lab, where they were experimenting and finding out things they would utilize in the features. But they kept making shorts in the 40s and into the 50s. And in the 40s, they did wackier, wilder things, partly because Walt wasn't paying such close attention, partly because they were watching those Tex Avery cartoons as well, and the Warner Brothers cartoons. And they said, we don't want to be left behind in the dust. So the goofy cartoons, in particular from the 40s, the sports cartoons.
They're so funny.
How to Play Baseball,
so
Hockey Homicide.
The Hockey Homicide.
That's just about my favorite. And
I
met Jack Kinney, who directed almost all of those goofy cartoons. And he was very, very nice and a wonderful sketch artist. And he showed me sketches he'd made of how he remembered the studio in those days. I don't know how they got any work done. They were always drawing caricatures of each other,
were.
You know? And he showed me he had started a manuscript of kind of a reminiscence of working at the studio, illustrated by him. And I took this to an editor I knew at Crown Publishers, and I was kind of the go-between, the midwife.
Yeah.
And that book came out. I think it's called Walt Disney and Other Assorted Characters. And it's a wonderfully evocative book. So I'm grateful that I met Jack Kinney. And then, of course, all the disaffected artists at Disney, the people who tended to be the better trained art school grads and more intellectual types, those are the ones who went on strike in 1941. And that's a big subject that we can't hope to cover here in a couple of sentences.
Right.
And they also reunited and formed UPA, United Productions of America, in the mid to late 40s. And they became a sensation using what we now think of as limited animation, but it wasn't limited. It was stylized animation. And they created Gerald McBoing-Boing and Mr. Magoo and a lot of wonderfully inventive cartoons that really were the equivalent of where modern art was going in America at that time, and graphic art. And that's a time capsule. And I interviewed a lot of the people who were like leading lights at that studio. Again, the door was open and the time was right.
So talk a bit about Tex Avery and where
Tex
that...
Tex is the one that I never got to meet. I talked to him on the phone one day, but I never got to meet him. And again, if I'd lived in L.A. then, it wouldn't have been a big deal to meet him. I could have just driven over to Hanna-Barbera, where he was working for a while. Tex, his name was Fred Avery, and the boss, Leon Schlesinger, thought it was undistinguished to use nicknames for credits. So he's always billed as Fred Avery, Charles M. Jones, Isidore or I. Freeling.
Yeah.
And as soon as that guy left, they all started using the nicknames right. on screen. Well, not that guy, Leon Schlesinger, who ran the studio and then sold it to Warner Brothers in 1946, I think. And a guy named Eddie Seltzer came in. And I think it was Eddie Seltzer, I hope I'm getting this right, who once heard a lot of raucous laughter and he stormed into the bullpen and said, "What's all this laughter got to do with the making of animated cartoons?" Anyway, Tex started out at the Walter Lantz Studio. He was from Texas, actually, in fact, and started out at Walter Lantz, and then moved over to Warner Brothers when Hugh Harmon and Rudolph Ising were still producing the cartoons, former associates of Walt Disney's from Kansas City. And they tended toward the cute. And just as they left and went to MGM, Tex came in. And he tended to rebel against the cute. And like one of his first cartoons, one of his first great cartoons, is I Love to Sing It. And which still has cuteness to it.
Yes.
But it also rocks the boat a little bit.
It does.
And
if you've never seen it, please, please go watch I Love to Sing It. It's just so good. Owl Jolson. Mm-hmm. Owl Jolson. If you don't get that joke, that's okay. Maybe one day you will. Every time I think about it, I start laughing.
And Tex started to exert his influence on the Warner Brothers team. Both Chuck Jones and Bob Clampett were animators for him and then graduated to the director's chair by the late 30s. Fritz Freleng had already started directing. He was the longest running member of that gang. Tex kept breaking down walls, breaking down barriers in terms of humor, in terms of visual ideas. He's the one who animated a hair in the projection gate at one time that somebody pulled out, you know, on camera, or had a silhouette of a man coming into the audience.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, unthinkable gags. And he used to have what he called an oh-no session. Anybody who was going into production with a cartoon, whether it be Chuck Jones or Bob Clampett or Frank Tashlin or anyone else, they would have a final sort of group get-together where everybody would give them feedback on the storyboards. And Tex called it an oh-no session because no one is allowed to say, "Oh, no, you can't do that." "Oh, no, you wouldn't want to do that." That was verboten at his get-togethers. So he left Warner's and moved to MGM in 1942, where he had more freedom and I think even a little more money. And that's when he really let loose. And it was there he created Droopy. And it was there that he devised, you know, Red Hot Riding Hood, Swing Shift, Cinderella, and The Wolf.
Yep.
And he worked with a very good gag writer named Heck Allen. But Heck Allen said it was Tex who really, you know, made it happen. It was truly a collaboration. Mm-hmm. Chuck Jones worked with a great writer named Michael Maltese. But it was the collaboration that made it so effective.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, these guys, and again, no recognition.
Yeah.
Virtually none.
Yeah.
Which is just hard to fathom.
Especially, I think, you know, and I say this a lot because pop culture fascinates me.
Mm-hmm.
But to see what survives, Betty Boop, of all the cartoon characters that exist, would you have ever thought that Betty Boop would be what she is in pop culture?
And
as this sex symbol type.
Right.
You know, people dress up.
She's an icon.
She is
an icon that, and the joke is most people who say they like her
have never seen a
Betty Boop cartoon. they've never seen her fully at her best in a cartoon.
Yeah.
A cartoon short. And so they have something to look forward to. They may not know it, but they have something to look forward to.
Yeah.
But she Mickey Mouse became an icon as well.
Yeah.
And psychologists absolutely. Have discussed that why babies respond to Mickey Mouse in the crib.
Yeah.
Because round.
Yeah.
The circles.
We like round things.
We like round things. We like circles. Round is friendly. A square or a triangle is sharp.
Yeah. And there too, of course, watching the different characters change visually.
Yes.
They
evolve.
We tend to like the originals, not just because they're original, but that's much like we've discussed that you have your own Batman, your own Superman, depending on what you saw first. I think that that's kind of how we come to our conclusions, is it's what we saw first. I want Minnie to look like Minnie, and I want Mickey to look like Mickey, and I don't like all the other random stuff. I just don't. In the same way that they're now doing these newer Bugs and Daffy cartoons, yeah. And I just want them to look like Bugs and Daffy. Mm-hmm. You know, am I the old lady who's grouchy in a corner? Absolutely I yep. am, yes. You know?
One of the nights at the new school, I showed seven Bugs Bunny cartoons, each by a different director. And the idea was to illustrate how different Bugs was under the leadership,
yeah.
the direction, literally, of Chuck Jones, Bob Clampett, Trank Tashlin, Friz Freleng, you know, Tex Avery, Bob McKimson, and you could actually see it. He's still Bugs Bunny. But Chuck Jones made Bugs stand erect.
Mm-hmm.
He liked that. And Chuck also, Chuck and Mike Maltese adopted the belief that Bugs would never provoke anything.
Okay.
He would always respond to being provoked.
Yeah.
The others had just different feelings, subtly different sense of humor.
I mean, and this is true, of course, also with Disney, mm-hmm. In the sense that some are saccharine sweet and some will. I keep using the word sassy because it's the best word I can think of, because mm-hmm. They're not rude. It's just that in no. some cases, Mickey had a little bit of an attitude.
I recently showed an audience the 1942 Disney cartoon Symphony Hour, in which Mickey pulls a gun on Donald, a gigantic six-shooter. And people their heads snap back.
Yeah, you just do.
In the seat, like, what? Did I just see that? Yes, you did.
You did. Man.
Anyway, it's a bottomless reserve.
Oh, yeah.
Of great entertainment, high art, disguised as popular culture.
Yep.
As pop art, if you will. And a wonderful treasure trove of movies to discover.
Yeah. And there's so much. I think that part of what is nice is because there are shorts, you can try something.
Mm-hmm.
A la the, you know, Pixar bringing back their shorts.
Oh, yes, which I love.
And which is wonderful. But that's something where when we first, moons ago now, heard that they were going to be doing a short, it was like, really? That was exciting. Because, again, for anyone who doesn't know, that was very normal with motion pictures when you'd go to see a movie.
I explain this, and people don't quite believe me or don't quite get it. But if you went to the movies any time from the 1920s to the 1960s, you saw at least one feature film, sometimes a double feature,
mm-hmm.
plus always a newsreel, plus always a cartoon, and then maybe a travelogue or
yeah.
a musical short or
yeah.
the Three Stooges or Laurel and Hardy. But always a cartoon. So that meant they were shown to general audiences, grown-up audiences, at night, not just on Saturday matinees for kids. So these cartoons were never talking down to an audience. They were never aimed at kids. And that's one reason that so many of them, that the best ones,
yeah.
like the Warner Brothers and MGM and Fleischer cartoons, that's one reason they hold up so well, is that they were, you know, they're entertaining themselves.
Yeah.
Chuck and others have been quoted on that. The other thing they had was they were kind of the bastard children of the industry. They got no respect.
Mm-hmm.
So they had an us versus them kind of irreverent spirit, rebellious spirit. And I think that comes through in the cartoons as well.
Oh, yeah. That's it's something that, especially to know when different things were made,
mm-hmm.
to understand how this character doing this character doing that, it really whether it's sexuality or jokes.
Well, the Tex Avery Blu-ray is a virtual catalog of World War II references about rationing, about the rubber shortage.
Thanks, Herb.
You almost need a glossary or a lexicon to understand some of them. But they showed those World War II cartoons on TV when I was growing up, and I didn't get half the jokes.
No.
Until many, many years later. I still loved them.
Yeah. Well, and that's a whole... The idea of propaganda in cartoons, and there's so much in the same way that you would use Elvis. You know, send Elvis because everybody loves Elvis. If Elvis is doing it, they'll do it. Well, if you send Donald or Goofy or Mickey or Bugs or whoever, you know, and you put them in that position, it's the same kind of a thing.
Yeah.
Teaching you how to be patriotic and in what way.
Donald Duck got people to pay their taxes on time. 2 years running.
Yeah.
Midst of World War II. It's, you know, it's an incredible history. It's an incredible, whereas Daffy Duck tried to dodge the man from the draft office.
That's right. Which is a very Daffy thing to do.
That's right.
It's, especially when you see some of the people that created them, a lot of it can make sense and a lot of jokes can make sense. But also the fact that, as you said, they play. So you didn't have to understand that Daffy was dodging to think it was funny. These different characters, even just violence. It's interesting to me about what was funny and what wasn't, what worked. The fact that you could have a series that's just music, something where you have Roadrunner going meep meep, and that's essentially the extent of the talking. You know, an occasional word, but for the most part, signs. They were almost silent.
Yeah. No, it's great. It's great gag. Execution, writing and execution.
Timing.
And timing, Chuck Jones said, the difference between funny and not funny can be one frame.
Absolutely.
You hold it one frame too long or you cut it one frame too short. It can make a difference in how the gag lands. We can go on.
Forever.
And on.
What I want to do with you is sit down and sort of have conversations about Terrytoon so people can sort of learn about each grouping. More easily. So that's something that we have to come.
Okay.
Let us know what you would like to hear about. What else interests you? Certainly within this realm, animation, what do you want to learn? But also just in general, we're here and we enjoy chatting with you.
Yep.
We have a good time with you. So let us know what you would like us to do next.
And where do people follow us?
Just here on the couch.
Oh, well.
We're sitting here. We're easy to spot. No. You are at Leonard Maltin. I'm at Jesse Maltin on Instagram and Twitter. And you can go to leonardmaltin.com for movie reviews, book roundups, and all kinds of good stuff.
And we're on Patreon now.
We are. Maltreon, as I like to call
it. If you like what we're doing and you want to help us keep doing it, it's a way to support us. And we do appreciate it very, very much.
Very grateful.
Go to patreon.com/MaltinOnMovies.
That's right.
And that's where we are.
Until next time, friends.
So long for now. That's all, folks.
Good one.
Today's episode of Maltin on Movies is brought to you by Legion M, the world's first fan-owned entertainment company. If you love movies as much as we do, why not own a piece of them? Find out more at www.legionm.com.